Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Mr. Andy Rideout, horticulture agent in Henderson County, Kentucky. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody.
Hello, Jay. How are you this morning?
It's a little wet today, isn't it?
It is.
I'm glad to see it. We're recording now in mid-April or so. Spring planting season's all abuzz just about everywhere you go, and we are getting some much-needed precipitation right now.
Yes.
Guys planting corn probably are thinking they don't need any rain. They don't need anything to slow them up, or planting beans. But for the folks that are out there fertilizing pastures and hay fields and have a lot of nitrogen down, they're glad to see some of this rain and what it's doing for them.
Absolutely, and I'm glad to see it too, because we were already behind in rainfall right now. And you know, going into the fall, we were behind. If you all, we remember that. And so back a few weeks ago, I called Matt Dixon with the UK Weather Center and just said, hey, where are we at with the drought? Did we ever really get out of it? And because, you know, we didn't have a really wet winter. And we did get out of the drought. But when you start thinking about getting down into that subsoil, that's where it's still dry. And so getting this rain now is going to be beneficial for us in the long haul. I hope, anyway.
No, I think you're exactly right. You know, we're early enough in the planting season that a lot of these guys that are trying to plant corn right now, they may need just a slight interruption to make
sure
they have all their equipment set right
and
maybe get this rain behind us towards the end of the week and be able to pick back up. I think we're looking for about 4 or 5 dry days starting Friday. So
yeah, and when it dries out, it'll be wide open then.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Well, we've got a guest with us today. David isn't with us today. He's out taking care of some work in his own county, but we've got a guest with us today, somebody we've both worked with, Vicki, for a pretty good while.
That's
Mr.
right.
Andy Rideout. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Hey, glad to have you here. We've kind of made it a habit the past couple of years that we've been doing this show. Vicki and I have done something garden-related. Mm-hmm. Both of us enjoy a garden. Both of us have vegetable gardens, and that's something we like to do. And we thought we'd actually get somebody who knows something about the topic to record with us today.
You know, I laugh. I tell people all the time when I get questions that come into the office about growing a particular vegetable or especially some odd things, but even some very common things, my funny comment that I respond to is, hey, I can tell you what not to do, and then we'll go from there.
There you go. Hey, that's important to know.
That's right.
Because you can get off.
I've killed more
foot.
Plants than, yeah. than a lot of people.
Well, I think all of us have that in our DNA somewhere. If you spent very much time in a garden, you've made some mistakes. One of the biggest mistakes that I see people make year in and year out is being a little overly anxious to get out there and get started. There's some plants that, you know, are cold crops that that are, you know, really tolerant of colder temperatures and don't mind a little frost here and there. But we've got a lot of garden plants that don't like that as well.
Won't take it at all.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm guilty usually by the middle of April, third week of April, of wanting to have some tomato plants out. Mm-hmm. I'll put one or two out a week, and I'll lose one or two a week, mm-hmm. you know, all through the end of April. So, mm-hmm. you know, personally for me, I always look at Derby Day, that's the first Saturday in May, as being at almost an absolute drop-dead time for being safe to get tomato plants out there. We have seen some frosts after that time, but a lot of times by Derby Day, by the first Saturday in May, mm-hmm. we're in good shape when it comes to our frost.
Now, I tell people a lot of times when we talk about the last frost date, April 16th-ish, mm-hmm. Basically that is not saying we won't have another frost. All that's saying is from that day forward, the chance of having a frost is less than 50%. Mm-hmm. So, and every day it gets a little less percent chance that we're going to have a frost. So, mm-hmm. so you are correct, Jay. Mother's Day is what the almanac always said, mm-hmm. you know. And so first week of May, that's your safe bet. Now, with that being said, this past weekend, I planted about 30 squash plants and 20 or 30 zucchini plants and a few cucumbers. I know it's too early, but they were getting big in my greenhouse. I had to move them out anyway, and I thought, well, we'll chance it, you know. And looking at 10-day forecast, I might get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you said you'll chance it, I think that's an important point to make. Mm-hmm. About the difference between our home gardens and maybe that commercial guy who's planting for an early market. We know that that earliest mm-hmm. stuff to produce that makes it to market always commands a premium. Mm-hmm. And people who are in this to make a profit, that's certainly part of that. The more they can make earlier in the year and maybe on the tail end of the mm-hmm. season, that helps peak that valley that mm-hmm. they will have sometime in between. But for our home gardeners, there's typically not a rush. Yes. We've got a little bit of time. Let's take our time and enjoy it, because after all, that's what we're doing this for.
That's at least half of what we're doing it for.
Yeah, and I think, too, the folks that are selling that for a profit, they're sometimes a little bit better set up mm-hmm. to be able to try to protect that crop if that it looks like there's going to be a major drop in temperature or something like that, that they're going to be able to be better suited to try to do some things to offset the damage that could mm-hmm. be caused. I know back, I think it was in 2020, if I remember correctly, because that was the year that everybody wanted a garden in mm-hmm. their backyard too during the pandemic at the beginning of it. And we had that late, mm-hmm. not just a frost, we had a late freeze around Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. And I know I already had my garden out then, you know, and my husband, he takes care of the garden more mm-hmm. than I do. So in full disclosure, he does a lot more work in it than I do. But we were out there and trying to find buckets and everything mm-hmm. else to get it covered up, and we was able to. But mm-hmm. You don't want to have to do that if you don't have to.
Yes, I remember 2020 very well, that late freeze, because that was the first year my wife and I decided to grow some cut flowers. And we had just seeded a bunch of stuff, and we're new to it, but we had a lot of flowers that were germinating and coming mm-hmm. up, and I'm rushing to Rural King to buy plastic, and I wasn't the only one.
Yes.
You know, everybody was buying plastic. So we had to cover all of ours.
Well, that backs up what Vicki's saying about mm-hmm. these commercial people. They typically have those things on hand, sitting there ready, the row covers mm-hmm. to get a good start on. Yeah. We think about the things we see on the news every year with the citrus growers in Florida. Mm-hmm. They're worried about those freezes in March mm-hmm. and trying to protect those blooming trees, and they're out spraying water on them. And same thing with strawberry plants mm-hmm. and things like that, trying to create a barrier. But in our typical backyard gardens, we can avoid those issues by just taking mm-hmm. a little time and waiting a little bit later to get planted.
Yes, that's all it takes. And I laugh a little because, you know, even though I work with horticulture crops and not row crops, I poke fun at some of my farmers in Henderson County because I poke fun of them because I would be the same way. They're anxious to get out there. They're planting corn in Henderson, you know, 2 weeks ago, and I'm saying, good Lord, guys, you know, this is early. What are we rushing for? You know,
yes.
So they have the same type of deal, but it's just funny to watch them in the spring.
Oh, yeah.
Home gardeners and row croppers alike.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there again, going to those guys who are in it for a business, mm-hmm. when you've got 10,000 acres of corn to plant or more, you've got a window of time when you've got to get it done in.
That's right.
That means you start when it's a little bit wetter, mm-hmm. a little bit cooler, and work through it. Same way with our produce guys.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
I think on the lines of talking about the biggest mistakes or things that I've seen is the other thing is it doesn't have anything to do with the planting date, but that they're a little over anxious on how big they want that garden.
Yes.
And if you're going to garden and you're going to garden right, it takes a lot of work. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a lot of work getting ready for it. It takes, mm-hmm. you know, getting it planted, but then taking care of it after mm-hmm. the fact. And then when it starts producing and how often you're picking and harvesting and the things mm-hmm. that you got to do, it can get overwhelming in a hurry.
Yep.
And most people, everybody works in the household. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. it's full-time mm-hmm. job. So you're doing your gardening stuff after you get off work or before mm-hmm. you leave for work. In the spring when everybody's got spring fever and you're ready for those fresh tomatoes and that squash and the cucumbers mm-hmm. and you're tired of hearing about soups and all that kind of stuff. And you got spring fever, it's pretty, and you get carried away.
If
and
one tomato plant is good, 12 is a whole lot better.
Yeah, or 30.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And you bring up a great, great point that I preach a lot to new gardeners or beginner home gardeners, is don't plant more than what you can take care of or more than what you need. Start small, yes. Because it, you know, our eyes overload our stomach a lot of times, and we think we need, you know, 20 tomato plants when in reality, for a, you know, 3, 4, or 5 person household, 2 tomato plants would most likely give you all the tomatoes you need.
more than likely we overdo it. Yeah.
You know, one of the things we have as a resource, we call it our home garden book, but the ID 128 publication, yes, that we give out, the Home Vegetable Gardening in Kentucky, actually has a little resource in there that you can use to help determine how much of a garden you
yield.
Need for your family.
That's right.
Expected
yield chart of different vegetable plants, and it gives you an idea of what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I think I always try to plug that in because, mm-hmm, to me, it's a great resource that we use quite often.
Oh,
that
yeah.
might be the most popular requested publication, mm-hmm, UK puts out.
Yes.
And I call it the Garden Bible. Mm-hmm. It really is some very good, well-organized, basic gardening information.
And easy to find the information
easy
you're
to
wanting.
Follow.
It's, mm-hmm, not hard to understand, mm-hmm, at all. It's not hard to find what you're looking for. Mm-hmm.
I remember the first garden podcast that Vicki and I sat down to do together, we both had a copy of ID 128, mm-hmm, and we thought, we're going to go through this whole book and this is going to be our podcast. And we didn't get off of the planning page at the very first of it,
yeah,
because it's not that big a book, but yeah, it is completely filled with very usable information for the home vegetable gardener.
No doubt about it. I pass out probably 200 of those a year or more, mm-hmm, to different people. And if you come into my office and start talking about home gardening, my first question is, do you have a copy of this book?
Yes.
Because even though I would consider myself a little more experienced gardener, not a new gardener, I have a copy in my shop. I've got a copy, mm-hmm, in the house. I refer to it all the time.
Yeah, I keep one too. I'm the same way. I use it and I refer to it so many times throughout the year. And in my office, matter of fact, I keep a copy in my office. You know, when I start getting calls, mm-hmm, while I'm on the call, all I got to do, mm-hmm, is reach behind me and it's right there because, well, I refer to it so often, mm-hmm, because in the summertime we do get a lot of those calls and I refer to that book so often now, and I just keep it close by because it's a good one.
It's, mm-hmm, a great publication from any aspect of gardening you want to look at, whether it's plant production, seed production for, mm-hmm, your plants, starting, yep, those young plants, mm-hmm, weed control, fertilization. It's very, very useful.
Mm-hmm. And container gardening, too.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's getting bigger and bigger, I think. Mm-hmm. When I think of container gardening, I think of small containers. I think of the 5-gallon buckets. Mm-hmm. I think of the planting sacks that a lot of people use. Mm-hmm. But really, if we want to expand on that, container gardening and our raised bed gardening, mm-hmm, I find more and more people every year are bringing soil samples in for those raised beds, mm-hmm, because they, for whatever reason, they've realized that that's a tool in their toolbox, mm-hmm, that they can use to help meet their needs. One of the biggest things that I think is useful about that raised bed is when you have poor soil quality. Mm-hmm. You can basically make a small bed of the best soil anybody could
best
could,
soil
could have.
Money can buy.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But I'm, you know, and when we think about how that translates into better yield, mm-hmm, better fertility, mm-hmm, better plant health, mm-hmm, less weeds, raised beds and containers are a very, very useful way, mm-hmm, for people to take advantage of.
No doubt. I talk about container gardening a lot, which you're right. It's very similar to raised bed gardening. It's the same type concept, but container gardening, that lets anybody garden. If you live in an apartment with a little back patio, mm-hmm, you can still grow a few tomatoes, a few peppers, a squash plant. You still can reap the benefits of growing your own garden, which I always like to add, the benefits are not just the yield of produce you get. There's a lot of studies out there that talk about mental health benefits of gardening,
mm-hmm,
and with container gardening, and even raised bed gardening, you can do that in very small spaces. And everybody can do it.
I agree, Andy. And, mm-hmm, I would dare say that all of us sitting around this table, that you remember your grandparents having a garden, your grandmother working in the garden, mm-hmm, grandfather working in the garden. And I know I do. My grandmother she'll be 98 years old in July. And growing up, she always had a garden. She loved working in the garden. She canned green beans. Mm-hmm. She she utilized every inch of that garden, and she, you know, and but there come a time that she wasn't physically able to work in the garden, and she, that was something she missed terribly. That's but true. She then transitioned into having her tomatoes, because she loves tomatoes, was her favorite. Having that tomato on her patio, and she could still take care of it.
That's right.
And you're exactly right. It's not so much how many tomatoes is growing on that plant. She was still taking care of that plant. She was still watering it. She was still babying it. She was, you know, making sure that, you know, any insects and keeping those off. And it's good. It keeps them busy. It keeps them doing something.
Even for somebody my age, you know, and I'm a little biased. Of course, I love plants and love growing things. I don't even like eating tomatoes, but I grow tomatoes because I like growing them.
You know? Right.
So, but the mental aspect of it, when I have a busy day or busy week, there is nothing better in the evening to go out and walk through my garden and see how plants are doing and pull off that hornworm or what have you. That that's what I enjoy the most, and not necessarily the harvest.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think we're all in agreement there. I can even remember, and I won't quote the work because I don't remember it word for word, but one of our colleagues at one time did a comparison of the cost of raising your own vegetable garden and comparing that to what it would cost to be to buy the produce. And I think in the end of the day at that time and those prices, it was kind of a wash.
Yeah.
You weren't saving a lot of money by having a garden. But I'm going to say there's a twofold benefit to doing those things yourself. One, the mental aspect can't be denied. At the end of the day, when you're out walking around and it's almost like you're just in your happy place, so to speak, you're taking care of things, you're doing something that you can round out the day and make that day productive, whether the day was actually productive
or not.
You know, you can make that day end the way you want it to. But I'm going to go back to and this is not a big discussion about whether you should be organic or whether you should use chemicals in your garden or anything like that. I'm going to say that the intake of fresh fruits and vegetables is going to be healthier for you in the long run than it is to constantly depend on bought or canned or processed, whether it's from a salt-saving standpoint or whatever aspect you want to take with it. Our bodies need more fresh fruits and vegetables, and that's a very, very good way of getting it.
That's about the best way to get it.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, a lot of people, with tomatoes in particular, one of the most commonly grown vegetables out there, and it has the most cultivars, most different types of tomatoes than any other crop. The taste between fresh tomatoes and tomatoes you're buying in the store out of season that comes cross country. And once again, I don't eat tomatoes, so I'm just repeating what I hear. but the fresh tomatoes are 100,000 times better tasting. And so you got taste, mental, there's just a lot of other benefits that it's hard to put a number on.
And I'll go even a step further, that canned tomato juice from those fresh tomatoes out of your own garden that you're going to use to make chili and vegetable soup with in the wintertime is much better than than, you know, what you can buy, in my opinion. You know,
no doubt.
And I think
now we did a tomato taste testing, and this wasn't necessarily on fresh and purchased tomatoes, but it was between heirloom tomatoes and hybrid tomatoes. And we did it for 3 or 4 years in a row at Hopkins County when I was agent down there.
They're still doing it.
Are they? Good. Yeah. Well, we made bruschetta and we had little blind voting, you know. And if I remember right, and I hope we can't find all the data from when I was there 10 years ago, but I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm correct. 3 or 4 years straight, heirloom varieties won the taste testing. The top three were always heirlooms over the hybrids, even.
And, you know, I can remember being young, my mother complaining about what she called hothouse tomatoes, greenhouse tomatoes, those that came in out of the regular growing season that you had to eat through the wintertime. That's what she always put it off to, is they were grown not in a garden, so they didn't taste quite as well.
Non-naturally.
I think what we all know now as professionals is we're all aware of the tomatoes that are bred. They're specifically bred to stand up to the rigors of being shipped across the country.
Shelf life.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of juice. They have a lot firmer flesh. They're a lot meatier, a lot heavier inside. And that's what we're tasting. That's
and
the
that's
difference.
And that's so true with heirlooms. Almost all heirlooms you can attribute this to, they do not have a long shelf life. You have to eat them in 2 or 3 days. They're not going to sit in the fridge long. They don't look quite as pretty as our hybrids and our commercially produced tomatoes. And therefore, they don't sell as well on the store shelves. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to taste, apparently they outrank the hybrids every time.
You know, and I'll take that a step further and say the same thing. You can take those same heirloom tomatoes and grow them under organic conditions, and they're probably even going to be less visually appealing than maybe one that had been used. So there's a lot of things to be considered. Mm-hmm. Everybody just automatically has that idea, or a lot of people have that idea, that organic is better. And... you know, I think that's an argument that people need to make for their own use, and rather than try to upend the whole market over it.
Exactly.
Well, and I think that's right, Jay. I think there's nothing wrong with purchasing or growing organic, you know, products. There's nothing wrong with that. There's also nothing wrong with not doing that. And I think that's the thing that everybody has to realize. There's not a right or wrong answer there. It's a personal preference, you know, and whatever you prefer to do, for whatever reason that you prefer to do that, that's fine.
It's much more important to me when we talk about pest control in gardens. It's much more important to me that you're following good practices and you're applying these products, whether they're organic approved products or non-organic approved products, commercial or standard pesticides, insecticides, herbicides. So you need to make sure you apply them correctly. Follow the days to harvest recommendations. Follow the labeled rates. Don't over apply. And I'll add to it, anytime we don't have to put products into the environment if unnecessarily, you know, it can't hurt not to do that. So don't apply them unless we know we have a problem, or know we are expecting a problem.
You know, and I'll tag on to that same comment when we think about the organic versus conventional production. We have a big globe full of people that we need to feed. Yep. And the idea that we can feed them all organically.
the math doesn't add up for me.
It's beyond the scope of what most producers are able to do. When you think about it, that we're still in a price point market, folks like to buy their stuff as good a quality for as low a price as they can. And that's where conventional production really holds
true. Role.
Right. That's the role in today's food production, for sure.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's the same thing in, well, you was talking about row crop, same thing, and you with non-GMO crops or GMO, that whole debate, it's the same way. You cannot continue to produce more and not change up some of the technologies that we have, or we're not going to be able to do it. Same thing in fruit production, same thing in vegetable production. I mean, it's just like you said. The math is not mathing. The math is not mathing. So, we're gonna have to do some of those things if we're gonna continue to feed the world. That's exactly right, Jay. Great point.
We've made some good arguments about the positives and pluses of that home vegetable garden. I think that's another one. If you want to know how your food is produced and you want your food produced under certain guidelines, and maybe you want to be organic or the term I like to use for most is all natural.
Yes.
I know a lot of folks who they're not going to use an insecticide if they can get by without it, but they still use a commercial fertilizer. I think we have a lot of garden people that kindly fall in that aspect. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's another plus for having that home vegetable garden is you can do it exactly the way you want it.
That's right.
And I tell you too, there's, going back to the mental health aspect of it too. There's just something sometimes too of being able to do something nice for someone else. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel it. That's not why you're necessarily doing it, but I mean, there is something to that too. Mm-hmm. And most of us that have a garden, I dare say any of us, every one of us that have a garden, there's going to come a time sometime throughout that growing season, you're going to have more than what you can do something with. Either you're going to be out of town. You may even have a small garden, but you're going to be out of town at the time that it's producing. And it's nice sometimes to just pick some of that and take it to your neighbor.
I run out of zucchini every year, too. I'm just joking.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you're giving it away.
Zucchini is, it's a gift that keeps on giving.
Yes, it does. Yes. Squash, too.
Yes.
But, you know, you're right. Vicki, we had this conversation before. When I've had those times of excess, I've taken some of mine to a local food bank.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a good outlet when you have that extra, mm-hmm. rather than letting that zucchini get the size of a, you know, big around as a football and as long as your arm.
A bowling pin.
Right, exactly. Go on and pull it off there early whenever you can, even if you don't have room for it, somebody does.
Somebody else can use it, and you know that's what? Nice.
I grow very few vegetables, but some every year. I grow mostly flowers nowadays, but even with the very few vegetables, usually weekly, we're giving vegetables to my sister-in-laws and my mother and the neighbor across the road and neighbor down the road. And I'll bring some to the office mm-hmm. a lot of times and people will grab it. And that's a very small garden. Imagine if you've got, it's just my wife and I. If you have a 4 or 5-person family, you're going to have a lot of excess mm-hmm. too. And you are exactly correct. I feel good that day when I drop off vegetables mm-hmm. to 2 or 3 mm-hmm. people. And they're so happy to see mm-hmm. me. And, oh, we love squash and we love cucumbers. And, mm-hmm. So it's a pleasure.
Yeah. There's a lot of benefits mm-hmm. to gardening besides the actual mm-hmm. produce that you're growing. You know, that's yep. for sure. So Liz, Andy, just, if somebody is getting ready to start their garden or they're thinking about it, what are some things to, I know we've talked about a few, but just from a production standpoint, some things to think about, whether it be fertility or, mm-hmm. or whatever, some things to think about now as we move into getting ready to plant it here in another few weeks. So
yep. definitely in the next couple of weeks is the time to start gardening, next 2 or 3 weeks. And I was joking earlier with you guys, I've already planted a few squash and zucchini cucumbers and I'm chancing it. That's mm-hmm. what I'm doing. I put them out there and we'll see if we get by with it this mm-hmm. year. So don't get in a hurry. First of all, we've talked about that a little bit. Wait till the 1st of May, first week or so of May. You've got plenty of time. And a lot of times we put the plants out early, like I did, they're not going to grow any faster and produce fruit any faster than if you wait till May. Very seldom does that happen. It could depend on the temperatures and so forth. So don't get in a hurry, be my first advice. Second, if you're are getting ready to work up an area or build a raised bed, there's 2 or 3 things you really ought to keep in mind. One is full sun. Almost all of our vegetables do not like shade. They may tolerate 20% shade. They don't like it, okay? So mm-hmm. full sun. Second, we talked about not growing too much. Start small and make sure it's easy to take care of. So if you live on a bigger lot, you don't really want to put that garden all the way at the other end of your lot, because when you come home after work, you may not want to walk down there. The more accessible it is, the better you'll take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
Along with that goes water. We typically have to do a little watering on our garden in the heat of the summer, and having it close to a water source is much, much better than hauling buckets of water.
Oh, yeah.
So, I'm not hauling 5-gallon buckets of water across an acre to get to my garden. So it all kind of goes hand in hand. A little forethought and your garden will be much better shaped through the year because it's easy to maintain. And those are just some good quick tips.
Yeah, that's great advice, because you're exactly right. Because when you come home and you're tired, especially in July and it's hot and mm-hmm. it's humid, and you're right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can talk yourself out of going and picking or watering or anything like that if it's not fairly close by. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. You mentioned some raised beds, and mm-hmm. so we've all talked about this. We was talking about it at length really before we started mm-hmm. recording. But in the last few years, there seems to be more interest in going beyond that container garden, as in a bucket garden or mm-hmm. something like that, but moving into having some raised beds mm-hmm. and some folks that's been gardening for years and years and years now, they've started using and utilizing some raised beds. Mm-hmm. And I know, we talked about it for my house, my husband and I are wanting to do some raised beds, and primarily the reason for that is for crop rotation. Mm-hmm. We don't think about that. We talk about that for corn and soybeans, but we don't always talk about that as much with vegetable garden. But it is important to be able to rotate those crops because they're going to require different things. And, you know, you can talk about that much more. But that, for me personally, that's one of the reasons that I'm looking into container garden to be able to allow me to rotate because I don't have a great place to do that. But, and there's other benefits too, I'm certain. But let's just start at the beginning. If you are wanting to consider a raised bed, let's just start right there.
Right there.
And tell, you know, kind of go through some things that we need to think about if that's something that we want to do, some things to consider.
So basically, raised bed gardening is extremely popular for several reasons. But one is we use, typically we would use some manufactured soil to fill these raised beds. And those are much easier to maintain, less weed problems. They drain very well compared to a lot of our clay soils around here that doesn't drain well, which equals less disease problems and better production, better yield. So all kinds of benefits. We can go all down that road if we want to about the benefits there. But easier to maintain is probably what I like the best. Now, there is a little cost building a raised bed because we typically would purchase some type of soil or compost to fill these raised beds with. And that's a significant cost sometimes, depending on how big a raised bed. But you can build these raised beds without wood around them or concrete blocks around them. You can do it with all kinds of materials or no materials at all. You can basically hump up a raised bed and grow right in that. Now, the difference is if you build a wood structure and fill it, that soil doesn't slope or fall down on you. Without that structure around a raised bed, you typically have to shore the edges of that bed up every year and do a little handwork to get it shaped back into a raised bed. But either way works, no problem at all. So I typically suggest get some wood of some sort and some screws and screw together some wood. There's all kinds of plans online. You know, UK's got a pub or two on raised beds that talk about using either 2x6s, 2x8s, or using 4x4 post or 4x6 post. But we can do this out of anything, really, anything to hold the soil up into a raised bed. Mm-hmm. So you can use landscape block. I've seen a lot of them made out of that. And you stack those, and typically you use a little construction glue to glue them together. Very easy way to do it. I've seen concrete blocks stacked together with maybe some rebar to hold them in place in the middle. You can build them out of I'm trying to think of some other materials, but
I've known some folks has told me they've used even metal.
Yes.
Like metal.
Oh yeah.
You know, sheet metal or
sheet
or whatever.
Metal with some supports.
With some supports. Yeah. And I actually had a guy last year came in and I was talking to him, and he took old garage door.
Yeah.
And
I bet that would be good.
And
actually,
he said that, you know, he's really liking that, you know, but he just had an old, replaced his garage door.
Yeah.
And he was able to use that.
No doubt. You can, I just thought of something that links it back to conventional agriculture a little bit, but the little galvanized metal stock tanks work great as raised beds. They're about the right width, which, by the way, about the widest you want a raised bed is about 4 foot, because that allows you to reach across 2 foot from both sides. Mm-hmm. If it's wider than that, you'll have to step into the bed, and we really don't want to do that.
I think that's a really, really good point. Mm-hmm. Talking about some of these different building materials that folks use, if they're using to enclose that bed some shape, form, or fashion, you know, one of the things I've seen people use is the galvanized metal, just like you're talking about. See people use railroad posts, railroad ties. See quite a bit of the use of treated lumber. We know that pressure-treated lumber changed their manufacturing process in 2004. They moved away from an arsenic form of treating lumber to a copper-based product. Talk about some of the things that folks should be aware of when they're thinking about using lumber. Definitely avoiding any old treated lumber from a tore-out deck or something like that you don't know that year of manufacturing on.
Yeah, and avoid railroad ties. They still use some pretty harsh stuff to treat railroad ties and telephone poles, some creosote type post space. And what we're protecting against here is most importantly root vegetables like potatoes, carrots, stuff like that. That they're going to pick up some of these compounds. And how much, you know, you science isn't exact here, but it's a concern. So the best recommendation is don't use creosote-treated products, which includes railroad ties, older treated wood, and telephone poles. Stay away from those products, but pretty much everything else I can come up with is fair game. You know?
Right. Yeah.
It's just going to serve the purpose of holding that soil in place. That's the mindset, is holding that soil in place. And so sometimes you may have to use some kind of a brace of some sort, like you said, with
rebar stakes work well. Yep. Fence posts, T-posts work well with galvanized metal. I've seen that a few times. We've seen some people growing car tires also. And that is deemed fairly safe. I've had a few questions on, are we worried about eating vegetables out of rubber car tires? You know? But we don't really have any science that tells us that isn't okay. We also have seen drain pipes, big drainage pipes that sometimes we use for culverts or whatever. Mm-hmm. We'll have end cuts off left after construction jobs. They work fantastic, and usually you can find those very reasonable.
You know, another thing that I have seen used on more than one occasion, I actually saw some this past weekend, folks will take plastic barrels and cut them lengthwise and make them in half, you know, put them in halves, and then build some type of support to get that up off the ground where you're not having to bend and being able to work around those. I've had questions about whether or not those are safe, and typically it goes back to what was in the barrel beforehand. As long as you know that it was a food grade type product and safe for use, it didn't have diesel fuel in it or something like that, then I think we'd be okay.
You do have to make sure in a situation like that we drill drain holes in the bottom. That's the biggest problem with our containers gardening in general, is make sure we have drainage. We're going to be watering this thing, and we don't want the plants to have wet feet standing in water. As you guys know, in the soil, it's a perfect mix. It's 50% air, 50% water in the pore spaces in the soil. And you start filling all those pore spaces with water, and I promise you we will have some pretty serious repercussions with our plant health.
I want to add to that probably one of the most common things that I see for growing plants, especially on patios, and that's the 5-gallon bucket.
Yeah.
You need to add those drain holes to anything like that to be able to allow it to let that excess moisture, because you're going to water them.
Yeah.
You're going to need to water those containers a little more often than just waiting on Mother Nature to do it. That type of soil doesn't have any water holding capacity, so you're going to have to add the water to it. But that water has to go somewhere. It can't just keep building up and keep those roots wet, or wet feet, as you put it.
No doubt about it.
No, because in that sense, you're creating a wonderful environment for disease to grow.
Big time.
I mean, it is the perfect environment.
And I do a lot of site visits to home gardens and landscapes, and I do a lot of them every year. And one of the biggest problems I've seen with vegetables and houseplants is overwatering. In a situation of a container garden without holes in the bottom, I can almost guarantee you will overwater it. I can almost guarantee.
Yeah. But that's a good point to bring up, though, Andy, because a plant does need the water, but you can water it too much.
Definitely.
And then, you know, you're going to start to see some of those symptoms on that plant that's going to cause you to think, oh, I've got a problem. But oftentimes you overlook that you might be overwatering that.
Yeah, they jump to disease.
Yes.
And a lot of times it is strictly a problem of overwatering.
Yeah, I've
really enjoyed the advent of these growing sacks that folks use, the heavy canvas nylon-type bags that they're planting in and lining those up in a row or whatnot. They allow that natural drainage. Yeah. And that's
all
something
through
that
it.
Really, really right. They'll come out the sides and the bottom both. But I think those are really, really nice. A couple of things is, one, at the end of the season, you can dump that soil out and wash them, fold them up, and put them in a box and
use
get them out of your way.
Year.
That's right.
Those sacks, I laugh. I like to make things as easy as I can, so I don't have to think about it a whole lot. And those sacks are nice because it's hard to overwater those.
Right.
And that's what I like. Make it hard to mess up here.
I've been thankful for the 5 gallon buckets that I use for something different, because it's easy to rotate in and out of. I use them for something different every year. Last year I was thankful I had all those buckets, because I had a terrible problem with the deer eating my peppers.
Did you hit the deer over the top of the head with a bucket?
Well, you know, that would have been a good idea. I should have done that. I actually moved buckets up into my driveway where the deer, I didn't figure they would walk between my vehicles, and they didn't. And I was able to salvage some pepper production that way, just to get them away from everything else.
So when we talk pest and garden, Jay, deer are probably one of the worst pests if you have deer pressure.
Problem number one, I think.
So I get several questions every year about deer damage, and I'll give you my little spiel, the best I can give you, based on some good research and based on good trial and error, too. But there's a product they call that's made with sulfur and capsin. One of the brand names is Deer Off. I think there's a few off-patent products, too, that you can buy. But capsin is what makes peppers hot.
Right.
Sulfur just stinks, okay? Right. And I don't think it tastes good either, so.
Yeah, it stinks.
You spray this stuff on your plants, and it's a very good deterrent, okay? Now, in my experience, that stuff works fairly well until it gets really dry and the deer can't find anything else to eat. It's kind of like broccoli and Little Debbie cakes to me. I'm not going to eat broccoli unless I can't find anything better, and then I'll eat the broccoli. I think the deer are kind of that way too. They eventually will eat it if the pressure's high enough and they can't find anything else. The only other solution I've found to keep deer out of my garden is a 5 foot apart fences, two of them, hot fence. And that seems to work pretty well. And for 3-4 years now, I've used that. And I think the University of Georgia or somebody did some studying on that.
Yeah.
So if you want the details on that, I can probably find it for you. But it's basically a standard fence, whether it be a cattle fence or a high tensile fence. And then about 5 foot away, a one strand hot wire. And that basically messes with the deer's perception, and they don't think they can jump at all.
Matt Springer, our specialist that works in the forestry department with wildlife, he was actually talking about that exact thing at the IPM workshop this past winter or spring, really. That's what he was talking about, and that seems to be a pretty good option for folks to be able to do that.
That method is used pretty extensively across the South, not only in gardens, but for folks in our line of work doing research trials. Because it helps protect that growing plant long enough for them to be able to collect data off of it.
Deer are tough. There's no doubt about it. Matt Springer told me that the only way you're going to almost 100% keep deer out is a 9 foot fence, I believe.
Yeah.
That's how tall you have to go.
Got to be tall enough. And even from that hot factor, you almost need hot wires somewhere around the base of that to keep them from getting close enough to dry it.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of other pests that you have to watch on our gardens. And that goes back to why we say start small and grow just what you're going to use, because once that season gets going, there is a lot of different, particularly insects that we're talking about that can give you all kinds of problems. We talked about the squash vine borer and the squash bug. I mean, in those types of things, you can actually go out one day or night and your squash plant, pumpkin, squash, zucchini, whatever.
Done the next morning.
And it looks great. And the next morning, it's just wilted down and it's gone.
Yep.
And it happens quick.
And once we figure out some of our pest pressures in our area we are, whether it's squash vine borer, whether it's squash bugs, or whether it's cucumber beetles or whatever, once we kind of figure that out, we can do some preventative methods. And whether it's cultural methods, mechanical methods, or chemical methods, one way or another, that's how we know, okay, last year I had squash vine borer really bad. This year, I think I need to get ahead of the game and put down some a seven dust or something to prevent these things, because I know I'm going to have them.
Right. And I think that's important to know. And the way you're going to know that is to kind of keep some kind of notes.
Yes.
on your garden.
Garden journaling.
Exactly. Yes. And know what you got, know what problems you had, what worked, what didn't work, so that the next year you can start.
That's right. I laugh big time. My wife and I, growing flowers, we just talked here this past weekend about what we wanted to grow in certain areas, and I cannot tell you how many times this came up in a 45-minute conversation. What did we have planted there? It was really good. It was purple.
Yeah.
It was like, but the problem was, is we did not write down what we planted, where we planted it, and I couldn't tell her. I'm like, oh, I know what you're talking about. I don't know what they were.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is that's a good point to bring up, is a little notebook every year will help you big time.
Oh, yeah.
Planning for the future.
Yeah.
Save you a lot of heartache when it comes controlling insect or yes. disease issues.
A variety that you really liked. A tomato, something that you really like the size of it. You like the
taste
of it.
Put a star beside it.
Yeah.
I really like that
one. So next year, that's what you want to have some more of those.
That's right.
All good points. Well, you know, Andy, one of the things we always do towards the end of this show is we like to wrap things up with a timely tip, something usually that's pretty immediate for the folks to be thinking about in their own gardens or in their own crop production systems or farms that we work on most often. But we thought a good timely tip for today would be that we want to remind people that preventing pest issues is a much easier way of addressing them than after waiting until after they're a problem. So now's the time to consider using like BT sprays or possibly row covers as a barrier to any invading insects. They're both good natural ways of controlling insects and ultimately would help what a lot of these folks are trying to do achieve as a goal is reducing their overall pesticide use.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. You know, and it's so important with vegetables, if you can, reduce some pesticide use. We don't want to eat those products. So I stress again, even if you're using BT, it's still an insecticide and we don't want to eat it. So be careful, read the label, follow the label. It's there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Sounds good. Well, Andy, we want to, we really appreciate you being here with us today. I think
enjoyed it immensely.
It's a good time. We say this is some of the best programming that we can do, some of the most enjoyable program by far that we do. So sitting around and talking about agriculture and about farming and vegetable production and whatnot with our coworkers. So
I enjoy it as well.
Pretty good time. So special thanks to Andy for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.